Ladies and gentlemen, unicorns of all ages, get ready for the greatest podcast on earth, Healthy Paranoia, where the email is always encrypted and the firewalls are ever stateful. Today in the center ring, we'll be discussing net neutrality. Joining us is Sherry Lichtenberg, Principal for Telecommunications at the National Regulatory Research Institute, Andrew Gallo, Network Architect for a large academic institution whose hobbies include ATM, voice, and terminating fiber, and finally, Derek Winkworth, CCIE, Packet Hunter, and Resident Skeptic. I'll be your ringmaster, Mrs. Y. Welcome, everyone. Welcome to Healthy Paranoia.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Always nice to be invited anywhere.
Well, maybe you guys want to go around and talk a little bit more about what you do, because you're all new on the show. Sherry, ladies first.
Oh, I thank you very much. Never thought of myself that way. So I work for a small think tank that looks at the impact of regulation on state public utility commissions and looks at the way that they deal with consumers and with the FCC. I've spent a lot of time dealing with net neutrality, including talking with Austin Schlick, who was then the chief counsel of the FCC, when he came up with the idea that net neutrality might be the right way to go in terms of resolving the conflict with Comcast. So, Andrew or Derek?
Go ahead, Andrew.
Thank you, Michelle, for having us on. When you said my hobbies include ATM, that I don't know if that was a slight or a or a compliment. And that goes back many years. I've since gotten off my ATM soapbox. I work for a large academic institution, like you said, doing all sorts of things from video and voice to primarily data networking. Network neutrality is something I think that it's a very important issue that I think is a little bit too complex for the general public to understand. So I am very interested in in explaining why this is important and how it can affect our democracy in having access to information and not being beholden to a monopoly or an oligopoly. So...
Great.
Thank you.
This should be a lively discussion. And Derek, you are our resident grump because I guess Greg was busy.
My name is Derek Winkworth, and I am the resident grump. I've been a developer, a network architect, over network engineer over the course of my career. System stuff too, and sysadmin, and I've done a lot of things across the spectrum of technology stuff. I've worked at large service providers, large financial service providers, government, and just kind of across a variety of verticals there. And I definitely have an opinion about net neutrality, and it's actually a little bit conflicted, so I'm looking forward to this.
Oh, great. So, well, of course, I wanted you on because I knew, if nothing else, you'd have an opinion. Derek always has one. So just to sum up, I wanted to quickly cover, you know, in case for the listeners who've been living under a rock for the last 3 or 4 years, I just wanted to give a quick little background, and most of it I'm stealing from Wikipedia, so please don't. I don't want the listeners to think I'm super smart. On January 14th of this year, a federal appeals court struck down the FCC's infamous net neutrality rule, siding with Verizon in their claim that the FCC has no authority to enforce the rules since service providers are not identified as common carriers. And we'll get into that definition later, of course, with Sherry. The case arose from a set of FCC regulations from 2010 known as the Open Internet Order. Basically, net neutrality is the principle that ISPs and governments should treat all data on the internet equally, not discriminating or charging differently by user, content, site, platform, application, type of equipment, or mode of communication. I believe the origination of the term was from Columbia Media Law professor Tim Wu. While judges appear to support the FCC's goals to oversee fairness, they did think that the current order was incorrect in certain ways, and I'm sure Sherry can get into that. So let's start with a little more detail on what happened exactly on 114, Sherry, and what the commission, what the court actually had a problem with.
So thank you, Mrs. Y. I love to talk about this order because it is so amazingly confusing. And like Derek, I am a bit conflicted in terms of what the order means and what the FCC is going to do. So let me start by taking you backwards to April of 2010. So almost 4 years ago exactly. Comcast filed suit against the AT&T, the FCC, because the FCC had told Comcast to stop blocking BitTorrent traffic. They were blocking and slowing down the traffic from BitTorrent because they decided that it was too much traffic on the network. Comcast, of course, didn't like that, and they went to the U.S. District Court, and we call that the D.C. Circuit Court because it's here in D.C., and it tends to handle all the really techie cases. The D.C. Circuit ruled in favor of Comcast and said, FCC, you have put yourself into a box. You have said that you do not regulate anything that is related to cable modem service, and therefore, by definition, you lose. Now, the FCC obviously thought that was a mistake, and so they came out with a notice of proposed rulemaking in June of 2010. And they said, you know, we really want to get a third way. That was the way they referred to their new idea of how to make sure that no one could block traffic using the internet. And the third way discussion ended up in the open internet order, which, interestingly enough, didn't come out till December of 2010. And right after the order came out, Verizon appealed it. And Verizon appealed it on a couple of interesting grounds. The first ground was that Verizon was equivalent to a newspaper editor. And so their First Amendment rights allowed them to decide what could be carried on their service. The second ground was that the FCC, because of the jurisdiction in Title I and Title II, and I'll talk about that in a second, the FCC could not make any rules or regulations regarding the use of the internet. And that, of course, was appealed. And the order that we're talking about today showed up in 2014. So what does the order say? Well, the good news is, I think, that the judges decided that they didn't even want to look at the question of the First Amendment, because we wouldn't really want to get into whether a carrier was also a creator of information.
How did they, you'll have to forgive me, I haven't even heard that. So Verizon actually it falls under the First Amendment as well?
Verizon said and I don't have it in front of me, but I will be happy to go back and find it. Verizon said, look, we're just like a newspaper. And really? So you can't tell us what we can carry. It was sort of a very interesting question that came up there. And as I said, the court decided, let's leave that one alone. Verizon also said, because we have a cable franchise, and this is amending our rights as a cable provider, and that's why Verizon jumped on this. Comcast did not, because in the middle of all of this, Comcast was merging with NBC Universal, and Comcast agreed to these terms and conditions, which stay in effect at least until 2018. So Comcast is no longer in the mix, and I'm sure we'll talk later about Comcast trying to buy Time Warner. There's going to be a relationship there as well. So the real issue that the court decided to rule on, and again, it was a split decision. Judge Tatel did the minority. I'm sorry, the majority opinion. And what he said was that the FCC, as you put it, could do some of what they're talking about, but that because the FCC has said that they only can deal with the internet and with internet traffic, primarily voice over IP traffic, they can only do this under their Title I ancillary authority. So let me try to do this for techies but non-legal scholars.
Thank you. Thank you.
The 1934 Communications Act, amended in 1996, which is where we started to see the idea of competition in telecom, that order set up two kinds of regulation. The first, which is Title II, because why would you make the most important one the first one? And so Title II is common carriage. Common carriage, if you think about the 15th century and people taking goods from one place to another, a carter under English law, English common law, said, I will take your equipment and I will take whatever you want to send. I won't change it. And I'll get it there as it was when you gave it to me. And on top of that, anybody who wants to send their stack of wheat on my cart is allowed to do so. I won't discriminate. So that's common carriage. And in the telecommunications world, we think about that in terms of the orders and AT&T's initial monopoly. That is, AT&T agreed that it would treat all communications the same, that it would make communications universally available, regardless of who wanted to send the communications, and among other things, it would be reasonably comparable wherever you were in the U.S. and affordable. So that's Title II regulation, and think about it as the regulation of Verizon and AT&T when they offer wired telecommunications services. That is your dial-up POTS line that so few people are using now. Title I says that in order to make sure that advanced services can be made available, The FCC can use its ancillary authority to make sure that there is communications available to everybody. And what what the net neutrality order revolves upon is this ancillary authority. It says we decided we weren't going to regulate VoIP specifically. The FCC has put itself in a box with that. But we have this extra authority that lets us make sure that the internet is up and running and available to everyone.
So the problem essentially is that that internet traffic currently isn't categorized as Title II. Is that the essential problem?
That is correct. And I think we really have to think about this in a couple of different terms. So we need to think about it in terms of voice over internet phone calling when you are using the internet as we are today to make a telephone call from one person to another, as well as the ability to surf the net and to go to any website that you want that is legally available. And so the FCC has very carefully avoided anything to do with deciding that voice over IP or internet traffic is Title I or Title II. It's just kind of stayed away from that. And I think that's why we're in this problem.
So I'm curious, why wouldn't they have just done that to begin with? Did they miss the boat? I mean, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, in the beginning, there were a couple of cases about traffic carried over cable modems. And if you think back to the beginning, you had an ISP, and you didn't have direct access to the internet, right? Your ability to go to the internet was attached to whoever your ISP was. You couldn't, as we do today, just go onto our browser and go any place we want. And so the FCC at that point, under Chairman Powell, decided that it would be better to leave the internet alone and leave the carriers alone just to see if they could build a better mousetrap.
This was in the days of AOL where you went.
This was in the days of AOL, and it persisted up until Chairman Jenikowski joined the FCC as President Obama's nominee to be the chairman. And it's gotten progressively more complicated as more and more people have decided to surf the net. And more of the traffic is being carried by the big guys, Verizon, AT&T, and, of course, Comcast.
Well, and let's get down to the nitty-gritty of this, right? The real thing that everybody is concerned about is cord cutting, is things like, first, the ability to secure your network, to traffic engineer your network, you know, what that means, and also the question of, you know, the cable companies fighting with Netflix and how they're going to handle that. I mean, nobody thought, I guess, in 1996 and prior to that, nobody had any idea that that Netflix was going to be what it is today, right?
Well, let's take this in a couple of pieces. So, first of all, this order says that you can manage your network however you need to make sure that it can carry traffic and that the traffic is able to flow without bottlenecks, without traffic overloading you. And that's called transparency. That was not struck down by the court. And transparency means that if a customer signs up for service from Joe Blow Internet, Joe Blow has to tell them, I block all cat videos. You will not, you know, and it's legal if I tell you that. The other pieces that were struck down were pieces that look like common carriage that look like the rules that are on the voice carriers who used wired service. So there are the rules regarding making service universally available. They're completing calls to wherever you want them to go. They are the rules about not charging one group of consumers more than others. And those are all rules that made the telephone network work and that have been pretty much adhered to by all of the internet providers, except, you're right, potentially in the case of a company like Netflix, who sends an awful lot of data, and maybe I would like to charge them more, or potentially make it impossible for them to reach my customers, unless they pay more.
So, I mean, there's been a lot of discussion lately. Now everybody's paranoid. I don't know if you've been following the news, but there have been reports in Ars Technica, Wired, all kinds of things of degraded Netflix throughput. Now, when they actually researched it more intensely, they discovered that the numbers had actually been going down a month or two prior to the actual decision. Did you see that, Andrew? Derek?
I did. I saw not only Netflix, but I also saw a blog post about cloud services or something being impacted. And I think Greg Farrell wrote an article where he sort of debunked that.
Yeah, AWS, and frankly, that's because it was some security company, and that's because Netflix actually relies heavily on AWS, from my understanding. And Andrew, you work on one of the you work on the I2 Gigapop, right, for the Mid-Atlantic region, and then you also you're in a peering exchange, the university where you work.
Yeah, I am. Luckily, we are in the largest internet exchange in the country, which gives us direct access to many of these content networks. So it allows us to bypass these transit providers that are potentially going to be taking advantage of the lack of the FCC's authority. And I want to focus on Netflix a little bit because I think it's easy for people to understand. One of the things that for a while AT&T has wanted to do, and their president has stated this very specifically, is he feels that content providers such as Google and Netflix get a free ride, and that he feels that these companies should be paying AT&T to carry their traffic. Well, that's a very telecom-related mindset, in that everybody pays the telco to carry traffic. It's complete opposite of the settlement-free days or the settlement-free business model of the internet. So if we take a look at something like Netflix, or even actually let's step back a little bit, there are services such as Gmail and Facebook that people use for free, and the criticism is always, or the description is always, how are these services free? If you're not paying for them, you are the service, you are the product. And the explanation there is Google and Facebook are mining your data and then selling it to advertisers and making, and number one, able to pay for the infrastructure, number two is generate a profit. The concern I have with the lack of a net neutrality regime or enforcement strategy is that we will now see a case where places like AT&T and Comcast will use their leverage as effective monopolies to charge these content providers in addition to charging their customers, their residential customers. So I'm concerned with, I'm paying Comcast a lot of money, or actually their competitor, whoever, and they're going to turn around and then use me as a hostage to force Netflix or Google or YouTube or whoever to get more money out of them in order to reach me. Well, but I'm already paying for that service. So they're trying to double dip. And that's a big concern I see.
Isn't this, but this isn't the first time. I mean, this, we've seen hints of this with the peering exchanges, correct?
We have seen this, and certainly there's still, believe it or not, peering fights going on. Unfortunately, Cogent is often the name that comes to the top, but there are others as well. I think a more apt analogy is in the television, the broadcasters versus cable companies carriage fights. And we've seen this recently with WCBS in New York and I think Time Warner, as well as the Weather Channel and one of the cable companies, where there's a fight over how much the cable company is going to pay the upstream or the other way around. And you'll get into these fights where the cable companies will turn off the station. So for a while, and again, if I'll have to look this up again, I think it was Time Warner shut off WCBS, which is a local broadcast station in New York. So people in New York couldn't get their local CBS if they're Time Warner customers. I am very, very concerned we will see this same behavior in the ISPs if there is not some type of common carrier enforcement in ISP world as we have in the other worlds.
So, Andrew, I agree with you that that is the risk that we're going to run. And I know that primarily we're already having a problem where providers are not completing phone calls to remote parts of the country, like Nebraska. I think we're not going to see it for a while, but that is the issue that the FCC is going to have to deal with. And it is the opening that the court gave them to consider one of two things, either making these providers Title II providers, something I think is highly unlikely, or using the authority that the FCC has under Section 706 of the Telecom Act, which says that the states and the FCC need to make sure that advanced services, which generally refers to the Internet because we didn't have a name when they wrote the Act, that advanced services are available to all Americans. And so I think that that's where the FCC is going to weigh in to try to figure out how to keep this blocking from happening. It's also important to know that there is a different set of rules for the wireless world than for the world that uses high-speed broadband. So wireless broadband, because of the problem with spectrum and the fact that there's not a lot of spectrum availability, actually can manage its network to reduce the amount of traffic that's going across it if it looks like there's too much.
I've been thinking about this net neutrality issue for quite a while, and you said, Andrew, maybe that there wasn't necessarily a core, you know, this sort of comparison with IXCs. And I remember back in 2002 that I was working at SunGard, and we had this is while I was in Philadelphia. Some rules were passed. That allowed a third party to interconnect local access to any IXC, and they could change it day to day based on rates. And the telcos had like a meltdown over this because they felt they weren't really set up like from a monetary perspective to have people switching carriers every single day. And so you ended up with long distance exchange carriers and local access carriers. Who they both opposed it. Like, of course, the local access carrier wanted to steer you towards a long distance service of their choice, and of course, the long distance service carriers didn't want to see, you know, all their services, you know, the valuation of their services being driven down to fractions of a penny a minute. And then suddenly there's a third party in between that's skimming off the top. So, and they didn't like that, actually. They very much disliked that. And if you, and actually, you know, I think the net neutrality thing is, I think it's actually not broad enough. It'll address maybe specific things about the internet. But if we take a step back and think about any shared infrastructure services at all, that including things like electric or natural gas lines or cloud services like Amazon themselves, I think with traditional services like electric and gas, you know, those are sort of sorted out, right? And how all that works. But they sort of suffer. If you think about how they do their billing and their service, can you imagine if the electric company came to you and said they were billing you for two different things now? One is for access and one is for the electric. And then your bill went through the roof. And the same thing with the natural gas lines. Well,
Derek, actually, the electric companies do bill you with two different charges, one for distribution and one for generation, because rather than the deregulation we saw in telecom where we said, okay, everything's open, compete with each other, the electric guys were smart enough to say, you know, we got to keep some rules in place. And so your analogy, though, is really good. The fact that we're going to end up paying this, we as end users, because if something like AT&T's new plan that they are going to charge Twitter, for instance, extra if they don't want your using your Twitter account, if I'm to be part of my data caps, we're going to end up having to pay for other things. So this is a slippery slope. And it's a slippery slope even in terms of allowing phone calls to get made.
I think I'd also like to talk about the analogy with the electric and gas and other utility companies, because I think there's a really good case to be made about how we handle last mile access in the United States and how that trickles up to the national backbones. And I'm certainly not running for political office or anything, but I don't want people to think that I'm looking for government regulation of everything and we should nationalize the ISPs. That's absolutely not what I'm saying. But what I think happens is if we start at the consumer, there are really only two places you can get high-speed internet access, and I'm defining high-speed as something faster than even 4G. I'm talking about wired access at home. That's your cable company, which is almost always granted a monopoly or at maximum one competitor, and they've deployed a hybrid fiber coax network, and your telco, which if you're lucky is no longer using DSL but might be using fiber to the home. So the municipalities have granted monopolies to these providers, and what that allows them to do is aggregate these massive amounts of customers with effectively no competition. And we're seeing that is potentially getting worse with the proposed merger of Comcast and Time Warner. I don't think this is likely, but I do have to say I think it would be very advantageous if the last mile was owned by the municipality, and that at exchange points in the cities or the towns, that's where the ISPs pick up their customers. This has been done in a very limited case in the United States. I believe Palo Alto is one place, and there are some other municipalities who do this, and I think it's also been tried in Stockholm. What we see when there's even talk of that in the U.S. is the cable companies will dump money into the local elections to prevent this from happening, and I think this I forget the last place that happened. Well, there was the Google Fiber going to be expanded in Utah, and Utah passed a bill saying that wasn't going to happen. But so, if we had more competition at the local level, I think we would have more competition at the national level.
So, Andrew, you are absolutely correct, and that if we had decided that telecommunications deregulation had separated the underlying network, the one that we paid for as consumers when the Bell system installed it, that network had been kept separate from switching. There were a number of discussions of that. Interestingly enough, both Australia and New Zealand, which did not have high-speed internet due to how big the countries were and the slowness of their national provider, have created networks like that, where the pipe is a public service, and everybody, including the folks who originally owned the pipe, the telecom company, need to buy service off it, and so they get the last mile access. But we're not seeing that in the U.S., and we are seeing a significant number of states that have passed legislation that says no municipal networks, number one, and number two, legislation that says we don't really care what anybody else says, but in our state, we can't regulate the internet, which essentially means we have no traditional oversight over the quality of service or the availability of service or the pricing of service. And Derek, your state, Wisconsin, was one of the first two to do that. You have no oversight over anything.
So Sherry, why do you think that they won't make it a Title II common carrier? Why do you think that's not the choice?
And I should have said at the beginning, these are my opinions. They do not represent the opinions of NRRI, but are purely the opinions of Sherry. And my opinion is that the FCC does not have the votes or the fortitude to do that at this point. Remember that there are three Democrats and there are two Republicans on the FCC. So the Democrats could actually prevail. But I don't think, we already have some questions about a new telecom act being written. So I don't think that we're going to see the FCC moving to Title II regulation. As Congress has said, and as some of the FCC commissioners have said, the net neutrality order may have been a solution looking for a problem, because there aren't any cases of blocking other than the BitTorrent case, which is kind of interesting in and of itself. So what Chairman Wheeler has said, the chairman of the FCC, is we're going to strike hard. And we're going to make sure that nobody discriminates on the internet. And we're going to do that in some way that they haven't quite identified yet, presumably by Section 706. But clearly some of the consumer organizations like Public Knowledge or Free Press are concerned about where we go from here.
So what you're saying is the FCC is going to come up with new regulation, and they're working on that now. But, I mean, I tend to not think that it's a solution looking for a problem based on the kind of peering exchange fights. I think they're just waiting for the opportunity. Maybe I'm being negative, but, I mean, Andrew and I had – I know Andrew's seen this a lot in the past.
The peering disputes actually, I think, fall a little bit outside this discussion, because that's when two ISPs will dispute whether or not one has to pay the other, and that is a very important topic, and there are some overlaps with net neutrality. I think this one's really focused on within a network, can an operator decide how to treat traffic potentially from one of its competitors? And this gets into the discussion of not its competitor as another ISP, which is where the peering disputes lie, but its competitor in terms of being a content provider. And that's where the integration of transport infrastructure and copyright ownership really work against the consumer. When Comcast is both moving the data and selling that capability and owning the copyrights and competing with companies like Netflix and YouTube, you get into a conflict of interest. And I think that is really where the common carrier rules come into play. But as we talked about before, it's unlikely that we'll see the restoration of common or the application of common carrier rules to this new technology.
I agree 100% with that statement. I read there were some notes prior to this podcast, and I was reading both the notes that were put inside the docs, and I didn't have that much detail, so I just thought about it from a customer perspective. And one of the things that drives me crazy about this debate, and that there are corollaries to this, in with software licensing on like proprietary systems, the cable companies are shooting themselves, or all of them actually. If you think about this, cloud, cable, telephony, and which by the way, all three are converging. They're almost indistinguishable from each other increasingly. The thing that gets me, I don't think they understand this, is that their access has no value apart from the content if they control the content, and vice versa. I have no reason to buy access if I don't want their content. And conversely, I can't get their content if I don't buy their access. I don't think they understand that. And if you take that one step further, it's crazy to me that I have – I'll give you an example. Right now, I can – like right from my office, I can see this. I have a DSL line coming in that splits off to a router for the internet and a cable box from AT&T. They control content to the cable box. They don't control content to internet. And both are enormously massive bills in addition to the DSL line that's now a separate, billable item.
Derek, I'm actually going to disagree with you on one case there. I think the cable companies do get it, and they do understand that the infrastructure itself has little value without the content. And that, to me, is why I think municipal ownership of the uninteresting part of the infrastructure would help us a lot in this case.
Well, would it also help with, let's face it, the reason why we're getting into this conundrum is that the infrastructures are ailing. This isn't just the case with service provider infrastructures. It's also, electricity, the electric grid, you hear the same problems all the time. But aren't they seeking new ways to monetize in order to prop up some of the infrastructures that, in a week they become aging.
So let me see if I can sort of thread the needle among these. And Derek, I agree with you, and I also agree with you, Andrew. So let's start with the ailing infrastructure. The copper network, the network that provided your plain old POTS service and provides DSL, is old. It is sometimes subject to problems, like in Hurricane Sandy, where it got wet and stopped working in some cases. It could be maintained. It's not impossible. And certainly the charges we pay for our telephone service would cover that. But the carriers want to go to newer and cheaper methods of infrastructure. And again, you've got to look at that in very different ways. Verizon did Fios, which is fiber to the home, but Verizon isn't building any more Fios to new places. Verizon is going deep, as we say, instead of wide. AT&T continues to use the copper infrastructure to take their U-verse product up to your house. And they've put fiber out to the curb. So we have to look at what we're talking about in terms of broadband. In terms of municipal networks, if you look at Google in Provo, Google bought the municipal network in Provo for a dollar because that network had failed, not technically, but it had failed to make any money and it was bankrupt. So there's got to be some way that we can manage this issue, and I'm not sure where it is, but indeed, what will happen, I think, is that if I have Comcast, it would have been possible without the conditions they agreed to in their merger, so sometime in the 2030s, if you will, Comcast could favor their own programming. If you have AT&T, who has no such merger agreement, they could go ahead and favor their own programming, as could Verizon. But it's really interesting to know that Comcast currently is the largest broadband supplier in the country. They have 20 million broadband customers, and when the merger completes, they'll have 30 million.
Wow.
And so it may be that because they're going to presumably agree to net neutrality at least for the next 5 to 10 years, that we won't see a problem.
So you're saying that they're, first of all, that the agreement that they made is still in effect until 2018, right?
That's the NBC Universal agreement.
Right.
And they've already said that if they're allowed to buy Time Warner, mm-hmm, they will extend that agreement for both companies.
What, and do you think a requirement of that purchase will be to extend that even longer?
Absolutely. I would say at the very worst, I would see it going, I don't know, maybe to 2025. I can't think that 2025 is another 11 years from now.
So, Derek, you've worked for a service provider. I mean, can you put on that hat for a second and talk about, you know, did you ever feel restricted by your ability to manage the network by these regulations?
Well, I didn't necessarily manage a network because of, you know, in direct reference to net neutrality. But I understood, you know, very well the concept of a shared leveraged infrastructure and managing to oversubscription. And it hurt us when, you know, that oversubscription management sort of, if you will, like a higher level algorithm that tells us, oh, you know, we need to upgrade these circuits or these circuits because we're seeing this trend over time. It hurt us when, and this did happen to us. Like, and a great example would be as a sort of neutral test case is when a very large company or set of companies that do business with each other suddenly spread a worm or a virus to each other. Through people sending emails to each other, and then suddenly all of them are flooding out onto the internet or over their MPLS infrastructure, and during that time frame, we see enormous utilization spikes on a subset of shared circuits. Now, in the case of viruses and worms, I mean, that happens, and there's nothing we can really do about that. But in the case of, you know, a company like Netflix going to Amazon, which is an interesting confluence there, right? Because Netflix has the content, but AT&T is doing the flood, or Amazon is doing the flooding. And then they sell their content and flood these service provider networks and skewing their over, you know, the way they manage over subscription. It's difficult to manage. I mean, it's almost like a catch 22. I mean, they can't provision infinite bandwidth. They wouldn't make any money. They're already in a lot, you know, in some cases, they're not making very, very much margin off the infrastructure they have. But at the same time, if they control content, you know, then their access loses value. I mean, I feel sorry for them, I guess. I mean, they're in a tough spot in some ways.
Well, I've heard Netflix is trying to get different service providers they have caching devices that they're distributing that they're offering to service providers. I don't know what the adoption rate is on that. I forget what it's called, an open interconnect device or something like that. Are you guys familiar with these?
Yeah, they actually offer that to anybody who will take some. At least the program I'm familiar with, I believe it's called Open Connect. And what that does is that'll put caching servers closer to the eyeballs, so to speak. And
right.
The consumers are referred to as eyeballs because they want to look at the content. The trick there, if I'm not mistaken, is that Netflix will provide them for free, but then in effect they're using the and that's a case where they're using the ISP's infrastructure in terms of their data center power and cooling and space without paying for it. So as an end customer, like the enterprise network I run, there's potentially value to those caching servers, and there are very specific reasons we don't use that. That's irrelevant for this discussion, but we did want to go down that path. So yeah, there are ways to get the content closer to the customers, and that is one way is the Open Interconnect program or Open Connect program.
I mean, you got to feel for these service providers to some degree because Netflix does seem very unbalanced to some degree. And I mean, if you take out the issue of competition and content, I mean, it is a very piggy service. Especially, you know, when they release a new show and they release it all at once, like they did with House of Cards, and everybody wants to binge watch it at the same time.
Now, yeah. Remember, though, that the portion of the rules that were not struck down was the portion that allows you to manage your network and lets the FCC continue to have some oversight, not on the management itself, but on making sure that customers know what kind of management tools are being done. So that I can manage my network as a provider, if I say I'm going to manage as a provider, and what I'm going to do is if Netflix releases a, you know, House of Cards, I'm going to limit the speed at which it's downloaded so that the network will remain open to allow other traffic.
Well, that gets a little iffy, though, right? I mean, it gets you could play a little fast and loose with that if you chose to.
You can play fast and loose with all of this. I mean,
right.
In the telecom community, some of the concerns are actually more in terms of, well, what if you act like AT&T did initially when it was a monopoly and say, you can only call people on the AT&T network. If you go back in history, before AT&T agreed to regulation and became a common carrier with the common carrier rules, some people had to have, there were competing networks. And if I wanted to call you and you were on network A and I was on network AT&T, I might have to buy a connection on your network. So those are the kinds of things that could be the long-term risk of this order.
So, Sherry, are you saying that – so Comcast, for example, offers VoIP. So are you saying that they could – your fear isn't so much for the Netflix side, but that they're going to say, okay, the only VoIP we're going to allow is our VoIP?
And that is a fear that has been expressed by a number of companies. And again, let me tell you that, Comcast can't do that, because at least until after 2018. But there is that fear. And that fear is based on what we're seeing today in terms of people not completing calls to rural areas. The FCC is accepting comments on their new call completion order. And so it might just be that we say, okay, you'll be able to call these people, but it might not be as good a connection. And that's the worry that we have in the telecom community.
So is anybody concerned about how this can segue into censorship? I know that the creator of BitTorrent came out and said that he is worried that net neutrality, that actually regulation and legislation could then start to become a slippery slope into censorship, is akin to what's going on in the UK right now with regards to, pornography over the internet.
Well, the orders and all of those orders say that the network can only be used for legitimate uses. So that there might be some questions there. But I think that the more important issue is not that these carriers will censor, but that these carriers will extract a price. So that they may say to BitTorrent, we have a deal for you. And if you pay us extra, your video will take precedence over everything else. And I think that's where the concern is.
Well, what about digital rights management? I mean, that's becoming a pain point for a lot of organizations. Is that fair to say, Andrew? You have to deal with that all the time.
I try and stay out of that as much as possible, and that is even a touchy subject to start talking about. And content ownership and integrity is a very, very touchy subject, as you say, especially around topics like BitTorrent. I'd be less concerned. I think the content ownership and copyright control is less a concern for net neutrality right now than what Sherry has talked about, and that is really in terms of money. You know, are these service providers going to try and extract more money rather than attempt to really enforce any type of copyright control?
I think my biggest fear is that I will see security people come down on a side on this issue that people might not expect. A lot of security people fear losing control, and sometimes some of the ideas behind net neutrality contradict that.
I think we might be making net neutrality a little bigger than it is. So, net neutrality said that I can't favor one provider over another. And as I said, the pushback from Verizon was, yes, I can do whatever I want because I'm an editor, and because I'm the editor of this this broadband world, I can decide that certain pieces of information shouldn't go. And the court didn't touch that one. You still have to be transparent. They still have to complete calls, the bigger issue will be in what we call the negotiation of interconnection agreements. So these networks can talk to each other. And that, I think, is the bigger issue than saying, I'm not going to let X piece of traffic go through because I think it might have a worm.
Well, I think, but that's an interesting point, because one man's virus could be another man's content. Think about it. I mean, at the university, we used to see things like this where, the Broadway show? And the song that the internet is made for porn, right? I mean, I remember us.
That was a Broadway show. That was a YouTube show.
Right. No, but the song for Avenue Q, right? This internet is made for porn. But when Andrew and I worked together, one of the problems we had, and I'm sure that it's still an issue, is that if students want pornography, video content.
Let me give you a great example of a case where network neutrality, even before the term was bandied about, affected how I operated the network we work on. So schools come back in session August, September. So there's always something called the September surprise. What are students bringing back this year that's going to be a surprise for us? And one year, it was Napster. And our measly, I think it was 15 or 45 meg internet circuit.
It was 45. I remember. Yeah, I remember when this happened. Yeah,
it was absolutely positively saturated to the point, and let's get a little technical here, to the point where BGP was dropping. So because we never implemented QoS on our ISP connection for BGP traffic, because why would you do that? So we had to implement QoS policies to make sure that the infrastructure was stable. Again, and I'm sure everyone will agree with me here, that's not what network neutrality is about. What we didn't make the determination or judgment on was whether or not any specific traffic type was legitimate. Now, Napster has a whole other problem, but let's imagine that was BitTorrent traffic. Everyone looks at BitTorrent traffic as a way to steal content. I use BitTorrent all the time to download ISOs to install open source operating systems.
Yep,
it wouldn't be fair for me as a network operator to make a determination just based on protocol that this is not something I want to carry or this is something I want to degrade. But on the other side, as a network operator, I need to make sure that the infrastructure works. So that's where really network neutrality is very hard. And as we discussed before, I almost feel for the service providers, because if they're making true tough calls as engineers to build an infrastructure, it's difficult to have the government regulate that, because government regulation, let alone legislation, is always going to be behind the times. But if they're making business decisions to hold customers and traffic hostage, that's what really kind of gets my blood boiling.
And I think that is the point of the net neutrality order. It wasn't to tell you how to manage your network. And that's why the net neutrality rules were much less for wireless companies that really do have to manage the network. It is to make sure that we don't say, if I am on Verizon's network, I can only make phone calls to people on the Verizon network, or only watch content or reach content that Verizon decided I could reach.
But you do see, Sherry, that it's possible that it can be interpreted that way, that the government could go down that slope. And I think that's what some service providers are worried about, and maybe some network architects or engineers, because all of a sudden you're then designing for worst-case scenarios. At least when I know, Andrew, you've been put in this situation. You know, when does it end? How many more times can you upgrade your links?
It is a tough call. Having just deployed several hundred gig circuits, it is expensive. Bandwidth is still following Moore's law, but that doesn't necessarily mean it's $0. Bandwidth does cost money. And I can see the service provider's point, if I play devil's advocate for a second, is that Netflix is – I'm carrying hundreds and hundreds of megs or gigs of Netflix traffic, and maybe my customers aren't paying me enough. Now, I don't necessarily know that's true, but maybe the business model needs to flip where the content providers need to be paying, and then the customers get their service for free by paying Netflix roundabout than paying the carrier companies. I don't think that's going to happen. That's just a bizarre possibility. But you're right. Bandwidth is a tough call. It's a constant upgrade.
Yeah.
That said, I think that what we have to look to is when, I think it's when, not if, we will see an issue. I think it's going to be a while because if I were in the marketing department in these companies, my lawyers would not let me come up with the great marketing ideas that I've got right now that not having net neutrality would allow me to put in place to make more money. But at some point, we're going to see something, and that's going to be the big question. What is going to happen if a company decides that there are certain websites that it will let you go to, but it's going to be a very long trip?
So you don't believe that they're going to appeal?
No. There have been some discussions about whether or not there'll be an appeal, and there are some very interesting questions about that. Because Verizon could appeal, because Verizon didn't win everything. Remember, the transparency mm-hmm. rule is still there. Verizon probably won't appeal because, according to the six really smart lawyers who were on a panel that I listened to last week, Verizon has more to lose. The FCC probably will not appeal. And the FCC probably will not appeal because what the FCC won here may actually be quite a lot. Because the ruling says, Judge Tatel's opinion, which is the majority opinion, says, you know, FCC, if you just call these guys Title II, you have all of this authority. You just can't regulate these people like common carriers because you've said they're not common carriers. So I think we need to wait and see. I am assuming that they're still talking about it, and I'm not sure how long it's going to take, although Chairman Wheeler said in California, in a meeting, either it was either at his meeting in Silicon Valley or it was at Silicon Flatirons in Denver, that the FCC was going to issue something almost right away. So we'll see.
Well, what's right away for the FCC?
Well, of course, that is a really interesting question.
Right.
Right away could take a long time.
So, Derek, what are your thoughts on this? You said you were conflicted.
Well, I was trying to hint at this earlier, but it's pretty clear that, in my mind, cable, telco, and cloud are merging, actually. You know, cable and telco offer the same services. There's no difference anymore between Comcast and AT&T at my house. I can get telephone and cable and internet from both of them. They control the content to the cable. They're, of course, you can call anywhere. And as of right now, I can, you know, access just about any site through either one of them on the internet. And what's interesting is they both offer cloud services. And they have to because they need cloud infrastructure to deliver their content. So what's interesting about this in my mind is, at what point do we get into an argument about, you know, we remember when the financial crash happened and there was all this, people were outraged because people got bonuses after this. And then these people came back and said, oh, it's a different pot of money. Well, from an end user perspective, if my service is terrible and they say, oh, well, you know, we had to tune something in the cloud, this has nothing to do with net neutrality on the wire. We had over-utilization problems in the cloud. It kind of sounds like you're saying that there's a different pot of money because it's an arbitrary distinction. If you build networks, what's the difference between a router that interconnects WAN circuits and a router in the data center that interconnects hosts? It's still a network. So this is going to merge, and I think net neutrality is going to have to maybe even change its name, but it's going to have to broaden its scope to include all sorts of leverage services. And I think what's going to end up happening in the long term, I like this idea of municipality owning the local access, but I think if I put my engineering hat on, the internet and IP as a protocol, as a technology, it wasn't built and out or designed for the delivery of thought about things in terms of burstiness of short-lived flows. The technology was not really meant to deliver loads of streaming content. It was never intended for that. So what I think will happen is that streaming content will end up being something that's different from the internet. And net neutrality, if I remember the arguments that were made in the beginning, it was very noble arguments. I mean, if you remember, well, suddenly they can download books that were, you know, over in some horrible country where they weren't allowed to read things. They can get online and suddenly read books and get ideas about freedom and democracy and a sense of, you know, personal orientation about the world and their happiness and their freedom. And, you know, we arguably the internet, urged on all these revolutions that have happened, right, in some places. But the content for doing that isn't pornography and it's not House of Cards. And I think that's why I think in the long run, I want net neutrality for the good things, but for content, I think in the long run it should be, and it probably will end up being, going the way of the current cable model. And I don't say that because, because I worked at a service provider and I hate the people providing the content, but I see that everything is merging. And when it merges, you can no longer say, well, it's this piece or that piece that's causing the problem. And it's not a net neutrality issue. It's one big bucket from the server to your television screen.
Well, it's like that idea. Remember that famous article by Paul Barron about compute as utility, where, I mean, I don't think about turning on the light switch anymore. It's just electricity is there. I don't think how it gets there. I don't worry about the neutrality of, you know, me getting my, you know, electricity unless I'm in California. And it is the idea, and we're increasingly moving to that sort of thing with internet where just 5-6 years ago where you would look at all these different DSL companies, you know, to find competition and this quality of this one versus the quality of that one. Now people aren't, their expectation is that it's just going to be there. I mean, I do see problems with nobody wants to pull fiber in, you know, ailing urban areas like New York City and DC just because nobody can get permits to dig up the streets.
So let me clarify for DC. I can't clarify for New York, but in DC, Verizon signed an agreement not with the Public Service Commission, but with the Office of Cable, in order to get its franchise. And by 2018, there is supposed to be Verizon Fios across the city. And so it is, at least in D.C., it's not the issue of getting permits to build bios. I know that everybody seems to be hearing that as an excuse, but it isn't. It's just that it's really expensive to build bios.
I would imagine so.
I don't know what the current numbers are, but Verizon, of course, wants to turn into a wireless company anyway, so they'll do it where they can do it. I think the point, as Derek said, is that it is one converged network now, and we are moving to a time where it is all the same, and where there are fewer and fewer competitors. So service quality, the reason that regulation has been reduced in a number of states is that the providers have said, look, there's all this competition. And if you don't like my service or my prices, you can go to the next company. But that isn't really true. And that's where the battle really comes in, is that if we could only find some way to increase competition. Because you can choose from maybe 20 voice providers who provide VoIP, but here in D.C., your choice for that broadband is Comcast or Verizon.
The last numbers I saw from the FCC indicate that about a third of the country has access to one high-speed provider, and an additional 30% have access to two high-speed providers, which means upwards of 70% of the country really don't have a choice. Choosing between A and B when A and B are effectively the same isn't a choice. And I'd like to echo what Derek and Sherry said before, and that is everything is converging on this IP infrastructure, which makes it a critical infrastructure. It's a critical part of our lives. It's no longer a nice to have. It's no longer a network of convenience. It's a network of requirement to do banking, job searches, education, and just run your daily life.
Go ahead.
Well, because of that, I think it's a really foundational element for any country, especially a democracy. And I don't want to be overly dramatic, but I think we can't understate the importance of this part of our infrastructure. And if you look at some analyses that are comparing the United States to other countries, the last one I saw was by the father of visualization, Edward Tufte, showing the relationship of the broadband speeds of the United States compared to other countries. And we're now way down in the 20s or 30s. And it gets even worse when you look at the speeds or the money we're paying versus the speeds we're getting. We might as well be a third world country. And that puts us at a competitive disadvantage. So, again, I don't want to be overly dramatic about this, but this is an incredibly important issue for the future of the country.
So let me say that the most recent study is the New America Foundation report. And I just did a panel discussion with the folks who wrote the report and the other side of the equation. So I think now that we are doing a little bit better, but the U.S. is still has less speed than most of the larger countries in Europe. I mean, clearly in Asia, speeds are much higher. I think one of the problems is that, the FCC has defined broadband as 4.1, and that's certainly not what any of you folks would like to define it as. But I don't know how. I mean, Section 706 of the Act may be the way that states try to find a way to do that. But I don't expect anybody to be building new infrastructure. We can't fix our bridges. So I'm not sure that we're going to be able to add a new high-speed broadband competitor.
We have to fix the electrical grid. I mean, that's one of
at least the electrical grid is regulated by the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission and the states. So I think we're going to find the money to do that. But we are at the mercy of providers to determine where they're going to deploy broadband and when. And although there have been a number of government grants for that, and we have the Universal Service Fund, that fund has a lot of has a very small contribution base now as people move from the wired network to the VoIP network. And I'm not sure where we're going to get the money to do this, but you're right. I mean, it is an essential service, which may mean we need to start treating it as an essential service, including regulating it.
Well, I think we've come to the end of the subject. I mean, we've certainly covered everything. So does everybody want to talk about what initiatives they're working on now? Whoa, quiet. Nobody's working on anything interesting, is that right?
I am working. I just finished a paper on competition that Andrew and Derek speak to the number of competitors and how the states decide whether there's competition. So you can get that on our website, nrri.org. And I'm going to write a paper now on how the states are looking at regulation or deregulation. As I said, when we went in, 27 states can't touch voice over internet protocol or any other internet related, IP related services. So I think by the end of this year, we may be up to as many. So that's my plan going forward. And we'll be watching the FCC really closely to see how they plan to get themselves out of the box that they put themselves in.
Andrew, what are you working on?
Interestingly enough, a paper as well. And I hopefully by stating it publicly, it means I'll finish it. Less a paper than a blog article. I think there's a lack of transparency and maybe humility is the wrong term, but sharing information about outages and problems that we see as network operators and sharing that information so that other operators don't have to experience the same thing. It's funny, maybe we can do another show and Sherry can chime in on this, but the FCC used to make their required outage reports publicly available. That's no longer the case. What I'm doing is saying for enterprise networking, I would like to see a little bit more structure in how we write these reports, and honestly, sharing them so that we can all learn from each other. And I come from the bent of spending most of my career at a higher education institution where this is just by nature what we do. Internet 2 is a very open community. So if I run into trouble, I'm going to email some list and say, hey, wait a minute, you know what? I just caused an outage. Yes, it's embarrassing, but here's how you can avoid it.
That's a big problem in security as well. When you're in the government, sure, there is some sharing, but a lot of that information is actually slow to be shared. They have ISACs, but what I frequently see with ISACs, information sharing centers, is that people will take but not give. I mean, information sharing either from a security standpoint or, I mean, business continuity is also a security issue as well. I love to see that. I stand behind it, but once you get lawyers involved, a lot of times what happens is they're worried about privacy. Oh, somebody's going to find something out. We don't want them to know. I mean, it's a problem.
And I agree absolutely. As we move into the IP transition, which will probably begin very shortly with some testing that AT&T and other carriers are asking the FCC to do, with the first set of plans due on the 20th, not knowing when there is an outage and having all of these networks that are no longer regulated really is going to become a problem. And we, you know, my constituency pushed very heavily to have these outage reports even shared with the states, and they're not. So we are, everyone is at the mercy of carriers to say, oh, by the way, my network went down 4 days ago.
So, Derek, what are you up to besides SCN?
Yeah, I'm helping, actually. You know, with our focus is on cloud, and so we're helping. And there's a great deal of interest from everywhere, and people who want to build clouds for the purpose of delivering services, applications, content, et cetera, et cetera. And so, you know, that's just going to add to the net neutrality problem, I guess, in the long run. But I've been working on a blog article about, you know, how companies, the way businesses are run, the people who run the businesses, they don't actually think about the product in whole, right? The end user buys a product or service, you know, knowing full well that, you know, I'm giving you this money so that I can watch this television program. But the business breaks down the delivery of that service into individual business units and expects each of them to recover their costs. And then exposes that ends up being exposed to the customer as multiple and viewed by the company as multiple revenue streams. And this is an interesting product management problem, actually. If you're looking at the product in terms of, you know, like the sort of the whole user experience of the product and how it's consumed, this is something you have to battle with every single day, because the people who belong to the individual pieces don't care about the overall delivery. They care about their part of it and recovering their costs. And so this is actually, I think, exasperating in some – I mean, there's a whole product issue around that, right, and how products in general are built from a technology perspective. But I think this will probably – and maybe I should mention this actually in the article. I think this will probably exasperate the net neutrality issue, because companies aren't the companies are broken up, and then the individual pieces are incented to not be neutral.
It seems like everything seems to touch on net neutrality somehow. Well, it looks like we've reached the end of another thrilling episode. That was very long. It's time to take down the tents, sweep up the sawdust, and load up the trucks. Please join me in supporting Hackers for Charity, a nonprofit organization that leverages the skill of technologists. They solve technology challenges for various nonprofits, providing food, equipment, job training, and computer education to the world's poorest citizens. You can get more information at www.hackersforcharity.org. I hope you can follow us on Twitter at Packet Pushers or at Mrs. Y is Y. You can also find us flying through the air with the greatest of ease on Google+. Remember to spend time with the other listeners on our IRC at Freenode. Visit packetpushers.net to read blogs by the ever-expanding Packet Pushers community. Subscribe to our RSS feeds and donate to the show, because trapeze lessons are expensive. Email your comments or questions about the show to healthyparanoia@packetpushers.net. And remember, it's healthy paranoia, because sometimes they really are out to get you.